Resurrect the Republic, Truth Radio Broadcast, on RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Hey, folks, Tom Lacovara Stewart here, Resurrect the Republic, Truth Radio Broadcast. So all of you know who are following the USV Astorita case, which is the case where the FBI fired on Lavoie's truck and lied about it. You can go to RTR Truth Media Blogspot. We have a regularly updating article with all of the most recent updates on that case. So you can do that. Also, be aware that we have a new channel on Real.Video with Mike Adams and Natural News, the platform aside from YouTube that has now basically just completely gone completely Orwellian. Folks that listen to my show know that I have some issues with Alex Jones, but we've all heard about the censorship. It's just insane. And really, regardless of whether you agree or disagree with them or anything else, these public subsidies have gone into these corporations in Silicon Valley. They're not just private corporations, and they are censoring everyone. And tonight I prepared for you, Ammon Bundy released a new video, and there's going to be links to this, or they'll be on rtrtruthmedia.blogspot.com, and it'll be in the links to the archives, a website, a really cool website. But he made a video and essentially a presentation of the proper role of government. And today I've seeded that with information that confirms, backs up what he's saying. So I want to share that with you tonight. Ammon Bundy.
My name is Ammon Bundy. I'm the third son of Cliven Bundy. I prepared this video for a couple reasons. One is a lot of people have asked me about the direction this country is going and what I feel is the main concern that we should be worried about. Also, I offer this video to you as a warning, a warning of what may come if we do not correct the things that are happening.
October now.
I know.
It's more than 12 months. You're a free man.
I'm here now on my own accord.
I'm honored to have you with us. Honored.
Shoulder! Arms!
Shoulder!
The federal government has not been given authority by the people to act the way they are. Most of the acts of Congress over the last 50 years have not been authorized by the people. Federal agencies are ramping up military-like forces to compel the American people into abiding by their codes, and the Supreme Court continually rules on matters that they do not have jurisdiction over.
Does the Supremacy Clause prohibit the states from their rightful remedy? Because your federal supremacist friend will say, well, the Supremacy Clause says that federal law trumps state law. Is that what it really says? How about we listen to Alexander Hamilton instead of a Supreme Court justice or a federal court judge? Hamilton says no legislative act contrary to the Constitution can be valid. That's exactly what the Supremacy Clause says, by the way. Let's look at it. The Supremacy Clause, Article 6, Section 2 of the Constitution declares, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof shall be the supreme law of the land." You see, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. Nothing else has to happen. It is the Constitution, therefore it is supreme. However, the laws created by Congress, and may I also submit the regulations made by agencies, are only the supreme law of the land when they are made in pursuance to the Constitution. Not every law is supreme, only the ones that fit under the Constitution. You can't have federal laws and Constitution on equal footing, because then all it takes is one law that supersedes the Constitution, then the Constitution's not supreme anymore. And if the Constitution is not supreme, from where does the Congress get their authority? Just themselves. Hamilton said, "No legislative act, therefore, contrary to the Constitution, can be valid." You know what he's telling us? That if the federal government is creating laws that are not consistent with the Constitution, they are no law at all.
Forcing the states into undue obedience. I would like to briefly cover the purpose in which the people organized the federal government, what authority the people gave the federal government, and how federal agencies today are the greatest threat the American people have ever faced. Before the federal government was created, the states had existed for several years. The states were doing well inside their borders, the people were thriving and enjoying their newfound freedoms. Economics were good, morale was high, and general social ethics were honored. However, when it came to matters outside the state, such as trade with other countries, disputes between two or more states, the defense against other nations, or the expansion and growth of the country, the current system was weak. Without an orderly system to handle these matters, the state surely would begin fighting amongst each other, and possibly even be conquered by an outside force.
Article 6, Clause 2 of the Constitution is known as the Supremacy Clause. This clause in our Constitution is often misquoted, misapplied, and misinterpreted. Those who support an overgrown and supreme federal power like to use this clause to beat the states into a powerless submission to every assertion of federal authority. Is that really what the designers of our Constitution meant when they placed this clause into the Constitution? The Supremacy Clause reads, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of the state to the contrary notwithstanding." A plain reading of this text tells us several things. Number one, the Constitution shall be the supreme law of the land. Two, the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance to the Constitution, are the supreme law of the land. Three, treaties made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. You see, the Constitution, through this clause, has been established as the highest standard of law regarding the federal government. The laws of the United States are below the Constitution. Treaties of the United States must be made under the authority of the Constitution. As far as the federal government is concerned, there is nothing higher than the Constitution. Alexander Hamilton explains the underlying principle of this clause in Federalist 78. He says, "There is no position which depends on clearer principles than that every act of delegated authority, contrary to the tenor of the commission under which it is exercised, is void.
No legislative act, he says, therefore contrary to the Constitution, can be valid. James Madison explains in Federalist 45 that the powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined, and those powers are to be principally exercised upon foreign affairs, such as war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce. According to Hamilton, when the federal government exercises powers that have not been delegated through the Constitution, the acts performed through that unauthorized power are null and void. What that means is, if Congress passes a law, and that law is not made consistent with the powers delegated by the Constitution, then that law is completely invalid. Thomas Jefferson reasserts this concept in the Kentucky Resolution of 1798. He says, wherever the general government assumes undelegated powers, its acts are unauthoritative, void, and of no force. The Supremacy Clause codifies this very principle that any law made by Congress that is not made in pursuance to the Constitution is no law at all. A law made by Congress that is not made pursuant to the Constitution is not authorized by any expressly delegated power. It is not the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state are not bound by it. The Supremacy Clause does not make every law of Congress, every act of Congress, every federal regulation, or every Supreme Court opinion superior to state laws and state constitution. It's the exact opposite. The states agreed amongst one another to be bound by their mutual compact, the Constitution, not to subject themselves to every whim of their creation. The Supremacy Clause, in fact, puts the federal government on notice that their every act is limited by the power delegated through the Constitution. The Supremacy Clause is not a limit of state authority. It is not a statement of supremacy of the federal government over the power of the states. The Supremacy Clause tells those in the federal government that their power is limited by the Constitution, and that the states do not have to submit to every imposed authority of the federal government that is not made consistent with the powers delegated by the Constitution, which the states themselves created.
In 1787, 11 years after the American people declared independence from King George III, the state's delegates came together in Philadelphia to discuss how they may resolve the concerns involving the unity of the states. The weakness of the current system was defined as fourfold: 1, foreign trade; 2, resolving conflicts between states; 3, defense of the states from foreign threats; and the proper way to grow and expand. Over 4 months and through much deliberation, a simple one-page document with 7 articles was drafted to resolve these problems. We know this document as the United States Constitution. In this document, it proposed that the states create a federal government, a central government, or a general government, and delegate these 4 main responsibilities to it: matters of foreign trade, an appeals court between 2 or more states, matters of national defense, and matters of growth and expansion of the nation. The document made it very clear to how the federal government would be organized, and was very specific to what authority and responsibility the people were delegating to this government. When the state's delegates presented the Constitution to the people, many were very concerned that it would give the proposed central government too much power. The delegates assured the people through many written and verbal communications that the Constitution was drafted to only give very specific power to the federal government, only enough power to perform the specific duties listed. Virginians and New Yorkers were so concerned about the Constitution creating a central government that would dissolve the state's power and put them back in the situation they just fought against, that they resisted ratifying the Constitution until amendments were promised to be added. Amendment 1 through 10, known as the Bill of Rights, was added to make it clear that the people were not giving the federal government power to make rules or regulations on just anything. Amendment 10 alone reads that if it is not listed in the Constitution, then the federal government does not have authority from the people to be making laws or acting on it. The people, through the Constitution, gave the federal government authority to act for, one, international trade, national defense, including border security, serve as an appeals court so two or more states can resolve conflicts, administer acquired or conquered land until the land becomes a state, along with a few other listed responsibilities such as post offices. Beyond these, they have not been given authority from the people or the states. Beyond these, the states and therefore the people have reserved the power to themselves. For example, let's look at our schools. Where in the Constitution does it list the federal government's authorization to administer and regulate education? It does.
If you care about your children, you'll get the federal government out of the business of educating our kids. In 1980, when the Republican Party ran, that part of the platform was to get rid of the Department of Education. By the year 2000, it was eliminated, and we fed on to it. Then we, as Republicans, added No Child Left Behind. So the first thing a president should do is the goal should be set to get the government out completely, but don't enforce this law of No Child Left Behind. It's not going to do any good, and nobody likes it, and there's no value to it. The teachers don't like it, and the students don't like it. But there are other things that the federal government can do, and that is give tax credits. It is for the people who will opt out. We ought to have a right to opt out of the public system if you want.
Where in the Constitution does it list the federal government's authority to administer and regulate the environment? It does not.
And on the environment is very, very important. People who are true conservatives and libertarians, they have no right to pollute their neighbor's property. You have no right to pollute your neighbor's air, water, or anything, and this would all contribute to the protection of all air and water. I don't believe we have the authority or the ability to go over and tell China exactly what to do, but setting a good example and to spread the information around would teach people that you don't have a right to pollute. During the Industrial Revolution, we did exactly the opposite. Property rights were rejected. They did not recognize the fact that corporations didn't have the right to pollute. There's a collusion between big corporations and governments that allowed the pollution. I mean, the governments participated in it. And once again, the worst pollution ever was in the Soviet system. You know, and the cows and environment and property went to the dogs. So property is better protected when people own the property than when the government takes it and rules over that property, assuming they're doing it in the interest of all people.
Where does it list the federal government's authority to own or control mass amounts of land inside the state? It does not.
Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2 says this. The Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. And nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state. Okay, let's break that down and look at it first of all. Congress shall have power to make all needful regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. Very, very clear. Congress, the federal government, is in charge of the federal territories. Okay? And prior to 1890, in Wyoming's specific case, we were a federal territory. And they made the rules that governed the territory of Wyoming. Okay? But on July 10th, 1890, Congress passed a bill for the Enabling Act to make Wyoming a state. The 44th state in the Union, okay? And we took our place and an equal footing as the other 43 states in the Union, and we became a state. We are no longer a territory, and therefore, Congress no longer had authority to make regulations and be in charge of the state of Wyoming because we're not a territory anymore. We're now a state. Now, the Enabling Act itself says this. It provides that the land shall be held, appropriated, and disposed of exclusively for the purposes herein mentioned as the state legislature may provide. Okay, so it's clear that the land within the state of Wyoming is to be managed by who? The state legislature. Okay? Pretty easy. So federal agencies still exist within the state and still claim jurisdiction. They're here only out of ignorance. We've chosen to let them. Okay? Ignorance and apathy. And if we were willing to submit to federal tyranny. The federal government has no jurisdiction within the state because it's now a state. It's not a territory.
Corp corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Okay, so BLM, for example. BLM was originally authorized, the Bureau of Land Management is originally authorized to use the Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2 power to dispose of lands. That's what the Bureau of Land Management was to do, was to dispose of it, get it into the hands of private citizens, into the state. But what have they done? They've set up shop here. They've been here for over 100 years, acting as our land managers. They're not our land managers. We need to get them out and say, you have no jurisdiction here. Because once you get these federal agencies who say they have jurisdiction, then all of a sudden we have to obey whatever the federal government says. But that's unnatural for the federal government to be telling us in our own local communities what you'll do with your land, how you'll manage this, what you can and can't do. It's unnatural for a bureaucrat in D.C. to be doing that, or even to have a field office here and say, oh, yeah, we work for the federal government. The federal government doesn't have any jurisdiction here.
And where does it list the federal government's authority to administer and regulate public health and safety? It does not. So I ask you this question. If the federal government does not have authority from the people to be acting the way they are, then with what authority are they acting on? Can the legislative, executive, or judicial branches of the federal government act on anything or on everything? Can Congress make acts of law for anything they desire? Can the executive branch administer on any regulation they wish? Can the Supreme Court rule on every matter? Have the people given them authority to do this? And if not, then by what authority are they acting on? When people in government go rogue and begin to act on their own, outside the power the citizens have given them, that government becomes very dangerous to the people. When people in government, bureaucrats, assume they can regulate on anything and on everything, then that is exactly what they do, and the liberties of the people are taken away. When the people push back, and they always do, the bureaucrats view those pushbacks as a threat to their power, and in almost every case in history, they begin to murder their own people. Over 170 million people in the 20th century alone have been murdered by people in their own government, after these governments achieved unchecked authority. The founders understood this danger. They listed very clearly what the federal government has authority to do, and beyond these, no power was or has been given. We American people are in a very precarious situation, whether we acknowledge it or not. We have a U.S. Congress that legislates acts for anything, acts that protect plants over people, putting citizens in prison for accidentally stepping on them, acts that can land you in jail for using the wrong light bulb, acts that force you to get health insurance or be fined and eventually imprisoned, acts that regulate the allowed temperature you can keep your home. The list goes on, and is added to in every session. The majority of the acts of Congress today are illegal. They do not fall under the enumerated responsibilities the people delegated to them, and they break the constituted agreements between the states and the federal government. However, as bad as Congress may be, the executive branch is by far worse. They take these acts of Congress and manipulate them into anything they wish. They file in the Federal Registry codes that, in their view, are federal law, making these already unauthorized acts of Congress into tools to give federal agencies unlimited power.
We have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it away from the fog of the controversy.
With military-like force, they come down upon the American people and threaten them with compliance to their codes, none of it authorized by the people. These agencies have found a way to create their own laws without the people's elected representatives.
Of what we intended. And we had to back them off. See, the bureaucracy wants to interpret the laws we write in ways they want. And in this case, they were wrong. Not once, but twice. And then a couple years ago, I learned that despite the fact we created the first cow-free wilderness in the United States under this law, and said clearly in this law that it would be the responsibility of the government to put up fencing to keep the cows out as part of the agreement, the Bureau of Land Management said, no, we're not going to follow that law. And they told a rancher they had to build a fence. I networked with my Democrat colleague, Mr. DeFazio from Oregon, who was part of writing this law. I said, Peter, you remember that, right? He said, yeah, I didn't like it, but that was the case. BLM still wouldn't listen. So we continued to push it. And they argued back. Well, it turns out there had been a second rancher who brought this to my attention, who they were telling had to do the same thing, build the fence, when the government was supposed to, under the law I wrote. The agency, the arrogance of the agency, was such that they said, we don't agree with you. Now, there aren't many times, Mr. Speaker, in this job when you can say, I know what the intent of a law was. But in this case, I could, because I wrote the law. I knew the intent. Oh, that wasn't good enough. No. The arrogance of these agency people was such that we had to go to the archives and drag out the boxes from 2000, when we wrote this law, from the hearings that had all the records for the hearings and the floor discussion, to talk about the intent. And our retired member, George Miller, actually, we used some of his information where he said the government would provide the fencing.
This is the most transparent administration in history.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Extendivite, a 7-herb combination of garlic, cayenne, hawthorn, bilberry, ginkgo biloba, valerian, and milk thistle. Extendivite is designed to strengthen the heart and arteries and help the body heal itself. Doctors are not able to explain the improvements they are seeing in their patients' health who are taking Extendivite. People who once needed more pills are now taking less and getting better. Due to the unexplainable improvements in their patients' health, more doctors are calling to order Extendivite for themselves. Help Extendivite make your doctor a believer. Extendivite is available in capsule or liquid form for just $69.95 for a 2-month supply. To get started, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Tired of being lied to by mass media? It's growing more and more apparent today that news is received less and less through standard media outlets. Even with a growing audience every day, RBN is beginning to direct more efforts into social media. Social media and the use of the internet is fast becoming the primary source of people for news, regardless of demographic. RBN has set out to provide some of the best news on the internet through republicbroadcasting.org and also has begun to use the tools to our advantage by way of social media. Republic Broadcasting is now operating a Facebook page to function as yet another avenue to have our collective voice reach new audiences across not only America, but across the globe as well. The Facebook page features not only news, but also an RBN player to listen to our broadcast. Get involved by visiting facebook.com/republicbroadcasting and liking our page and share it with your friends and family, because you can handle the truth.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AROutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AROutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. Plus Magpul clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to AROutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at AROutfitting.com.
Some of his information where he said the government would provide the fencing. They were still reluctant to follow it. So I put language in the appropriations bill that restated the federal law. Do you understand how frustrated I am at this? Can you imagine how the people on the ground feel?
Over the past several decades, they have been organizing their own law enforcement regiments, building their own prison systems, and appointing their own judges. With this fraudulent system, they can arrest, prosecute, and incarcerate the American people for noncompliance to their arbitrary rules. All of this is done outside the proper legal system sanctioned by the people, making it futile for the American people to get justice when caught in this counterfeit judicial system, and making it feasible for bureaucrats to embezzle, abuse, oppress, incarcerate, and even murder the American people without afterwards even as much as an investigation.
Luca Brasi held a gun to his head, and my father assured him that either his brains or his signature would be on the contract.
The American people are in a very precarious situation. To sum things up, the people created the federal government to perform specific duties that were better performed by a central government. The people gave the federal government authority to only perform those certain duties. The U.S. Constitution lists those certain duties. The federal government has neglected those duties. And U.S. Congress, with no respect for the people, are making acts way outside the list of authorized duties. Current and past presidents have created hundreds of federal agencies that have nothing to do with the listed responsibilities. And now these federal agencies have become so powerful that not even Congress or the president can rein them in or defund them.
Most people know that a new president gets to name over 4,000 political appointees when they're elected. This political cronyism is partisan politics, and it fills our bloated government with unqualified employees. Some people think that these are the people that comprise the deep state. But the deep state is much deeper than this. There's a much more sinister system in place that controls Washington, D.C.'s bureaucracies through an actual organized government. It's the heart of the swamp. The Washington, D.C. deep state is a group of 8,156 appointed managers in 75 federal agencies that control the power and tell the new political appointees what they can and cannot do. That's right. The deep state is an official government program, well-organized, comprehensive, and in charge. Out of the 8,156 members of these ensconced bureaucrats, over 7,000 were appointed by Obama. These are the Obama holdovers that still control the executive branch of government a full year after Trump has come to office. Obama expanded the existing program of managers and appointed over 7,000 of the 8,156 bosses, who are called the Senior Executive Service. Some call it the shadow government, and it's true that this federal cabal works in the shadows. Although the government clearly states that it's forbidden to have a senior executive service system in the Department of Justice, accessing the last in the list of links I provided in the production notes proves otherwise. The names of the senior executive service members are never revealed, but we do have a list of the people who give raises to the SES members in the Department of Justice. Raises for these SES members who don't exist, but are the bosses. Take note of this lapel pin. It's worn by SES members, so they are able to identify one another. Now that you know who they are, going forward, you'll be able to spot them and know that they're not promoting President Donald Trump's agenda. We need to take measures to end the senior executive service and topple the deep state shadow government that has 8,156 operatives in 75 federal agencies, all still working to promote Barack Obama's political agenda.
These bureaucrats today understand that the American people are becoming weary to their actions. They are building up forces so they can stay in power when the American people finally realize that they are no more than modern-day conquerors, just self-appointed predators. Now, two questions. Are law-abiding citizens obligated to obey unauthorized laws, codes, or regulations? And is it the duty of the citizen to make sure people in government only exercise on the authority given them? To present such gloomy information without some solution would not seem honorable. Yes, the above facts are alarming and extremely concerning. History is repeating itself. But there is a way that we can protect our liberties from the buffetings of these bureaucratic bullies. It is not easy, but I have personally seen it happen successfully several times. One of the founding principles that this nation was built upon is the right to local self-government and the protection of it.
At the close of World War II, most American veterans returned from the battlefield looking forward to settling down to a peaceful life. But for the returning warriors of Athens, Tennessee, that dream became a nightmare. The men who had vanquished the forces of fascism overseas were now confronted by a new enemy at home, a local government rife with corruption and abuse. The conflict that followed pitted an entrenched political machine against an armed citizenry fed up with their overlords. It was known as the Battle of Athens, and it's the topic of tonight's Real History.
Athens, Tennessee in the mid-40s was the county seat of McMinn County. It had always been a hotbed of political dissent and political eruption. By 1940, the problem was that there was a political machine and they were pretty much dominating the lives of the people. People that would come through town on buses or trains could be regularly pulled off and beaten up, accused of some crime and thrown into jail. The more prisoners that went into jail, the more money that went into the sheriff's budget. There would have been all kinds of moonshine stills and illegal liquor, and so the sheriff would have gained money from them. There were all kinds of activities in which these male deputies almost had free rein of the female population. There was a large part of the male population that was away at war. It became a common theme by war's end, wait till the boys get back. It was like there was a kind of a crescendo of emotion that was building as these men began to drift back in after the war. There may have been a time in which they thought this was business as usual, but you had these men coming back saying, "We fought for liberty in Europe and the Pacific." The men were encouraged to form a political party. The party was called the GI Nonpartisan Party. Election day was August the 2nd, 1946. The election was for all of the county offices, primarily and of most importance, the office of sheriff. The veterans had put a person forward on their nonpartisan ticket by the name of Knox Henry. And Knox Henry was kind of a grand figure. He was almost a John Wayne type person. And so he was the kind of person who would have garnered a lot of votes. Now, that being said, the political establishment kept saying to themselves that all they had to do was to control the ballot boxes. And so you had poll watchers. And these poll watchers would have been there from the establishment. Those were usually deputies, and they were usually armed. There would have been other poll watchers that would have come from the GI party, and those would have been veterans that were in there watching the votes. The first most dramatic event occurred on one of the main streets of Athens. Two of the GI watchers, a man named Shai Scott and a man named David Vestal, were in there with these deputies. There was a man in the community named Tom Gillespie. Tom Gillespie was an older African-American man. He was much beloved. He was highly respected. Immediately, these tough, ugly deputies feel like that's someone that they can easily not let vote. And so they push him back. And Tom Gillespie, very heroically, determines that he is going to vote. Finally, he's warned that if he doesn't leave, he's going to be shot. And at that moment, he says, "I've come to vote. It's my right." And one of the deputies produces a gun and shoots Tom Gillespie on the spot. The deputies immediately shut down the precinct, and they are holding the two poll watchers captive inside the precinct. All of a sudden, you can hear sirens coming, and the sheriff and a whole group of heavily armed deputies come in, push the crowds back, and begin to clear out the ballot boxes and move them to the jail. Word is then spread throughout the county that voting precincts are to be shut down and ballot boxes are beginning to be brought to the jail. And so suddenly it's put up or shut up time. The sheriff and the deputies have barricaded themselves heavily armed in the county jail. It's like a fortress almost. A man named Mink Powers stepped in and took a leadership role. And he made it possible for some keys to the armory to show up. And so veterans began to go to the armory and began to bring weapons down to town. If you saw the kind of layout of the town, there is a small ridge that looks down over the area where the jail was. So, of course, these soldiers knew that that gave them tactical advantage that was just unbelievable. Everything was totally quiet. Everything had suddenly gotten dark. And gunfire erupts from the jail. That firing goes on for probably about 3 hours. I mean, it was like the Alamo almost in our TV images. A veteran that had been involved with munitions in the war taped together several sticks of dynamite. The dynamite blew off the whole front of the jail. And all of a sudden, the people in the jail believe this thing's been raised to a new level. So you literally have a white flag that is rigged and stuck out of the jail windows, and the people in the jail surrender. By the time that the next morning occurs, the veterans, the people from the business community in town, they were able to count the votes. The election was not even close. The Veterans GI Nonpartisan Party won by a majority. The legacy of these events are manifold. By the time that you get to the political events of 1948, there are numerous events like what happened at Athens that are repeated across the country. The GI Nonpartisan Party came very close to being the first vital third-party movement in America to really become successful.
Federalism by doctrine means that each level of government checks and balances the other levels. When any level of government begins to act outside the authority the people have given it, it is the right and the duty of the people and other levels of government to put that government back in its place. As a prudent society, we have been wielded into thinking that the way to check and balance government is through the courts. This is simply not true for many reasons. The only way to ultimately check and balance and preserve liberties is by not allowing the action to continue. Federal, state, counties, and most important, the people, must not comply under any circumstance to legislation or regulation that violates the constituted agreements made with each other. We have found ourselves in this precarious situation because either we are ignorant to the constituted outlines, or we are not brave enough to stand when we know something is not right. What the federal government is doing is illegal, and will continue to destroy our freedoms until there are none left. The people must not stand for it. We have been the land of the free because of the brave. And if we do not exhibit bravery, suppressing fear, we cannot be free. This is an eternal principle. It is time for you to organize those around you and insist that your state, your county, your schools, and your city, and yourselves do not comply to the illegal, arbitrary action of the federal government.
We propose to dismantle two cabinet departments, energy and education. Both secretaries are wholly in accord with this. Some of the activities in both of these departments will, of course, be continued either independently or in other areas of government. There's only one way to shrink the size and cost of big government, and that is by eliminating agencies that are not needed and are getting in the way of a solution. Now, we don't need an energy department to solve our basic energy problem. As long as we let the forces of the marketplace work without undue interference, the ingenuity of consumers, business, producers, and inventors will do that for us. Similarly, education is the principal responsibility of local school systems, teachers, parents, citizen boards, and state governments. By eliminating the Department of Education less than 2 years after it was created, we can not only reduce the budget, but ensure that local needs and preferences, rather than the wishes of Washington, determine the education of our children.
My name is Charlotte Thompson Nesserbate, and I served as senior policy advisor in the United States Department of Education under the Reagan administration, during which I had access to all of the most important documents for the restructuring of not only American education, but global education. And I'm also the author of The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America, which gets into all of this, gives the background of what I saw not only in the Department of Education, but as a local school board member. I was trained to identify the resistors. The resistors to the sex ed, drug ed, alcohol ed, suicide ed, death ed, those good, smart Americans who realize that anything that has education hanging off the end of it is probably not what they're looking for. I was trained to identify those good people and to go up against them and actually to go and try to get them to join us through the group process system, make them feel important, get them on a committee. And when I, that just blew my mind. I have to say, people often ask me, what is it that got you involved in education? Well, finding out what I saw at the local level certainly upset me. When I went and I saw that Americans were being trained to identify resistors, you know, then I got pretty upset. And luckily, there was a big book that came with the in-service training called Innovations in Education, A Change Agent's Guide. And I was able to take that back home with me. Unbelievable examples of how to con the Christians and different people who are upset with what you're trying to do, how to bring them over to your side, case studies, true case studies of educators who had put programs in that normally, you know, in a normal American town, nobody would want them. How did they manage to get them in? How did they con the people? And the other thing was, not only was I trained to identify the resistors, I was trained to go to the important people, high-profile, highly thought-of people in the community, with the Rotary, Chamber of Commerce, Garden Club, you name it, the different groups in our towns. Go to them and convince them of the importance of these new programs, like sex ed, drug ed, I just mentioned all of them, and get them on your side, because when you can get the leadership in a community to go along with it, then the newspaper comes in and says, you know, a committee's been set up with the head of the Rotary and this and that, and they're all getting behind this task force to discuss whether we're going to have a new sex education program. And then when Mary Jones, you know, who ordinarily would think, why would we want to have a sex education program when we don't have any problems with kids having sex or anything, so she might be you know, concerned. She might be one of the resistors. She reads that her best friend, who's the head of the garden club, is on this committee, and she thinks, oh, well, hey, Mary Appleton is on that committee. She's heading it up. Must be okay. So I was taught really how to con the community. They always call everybody by the first name. You have to get very, you know, affectionate with people and say, William, you know, I'm so glad you've come to this meeting, and I understand your concerns about this program, because you know, I've had other people, usually it's the really bright people in the community who have these concerns, and would you like to join our group? The original program was funded by what would subsequently become my office. It was funded by the Office of Research in the U.S. Office of Education, because it was funded early on, about the late 60s, still funded, by the way. And the money went to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor to a professor by the name of Ronald Havelock. And he was the one that put together the whole training, the whole seminar, the book. And in the back of the book you had, they admitted it, right in the back of the book, they had about 100 major change agents listed from all over the country. Some of them I recognize, some I still don't, but some I do. And so this was a very important project. And it was being, you know, it was being carried out in our, I'm sure, all over the country, not just where I was. This was in Searsport, Maine, this lovely little town on the coast of Maine, in the school there where the guy came in, the facilitator, not Professor Havelock, but a facilitator, to train us. And these were good people that were there. You know, they were some of the teachers from my school, where I was on the local school board, principals, etc. Normal-looking Americans. You know, you really ask yourself, they must themselves have reacted very much the way I did. That's why I've always had a lot of understanding for teachers that have to go through this stuff. I didn't have to continue going through it. They've had to, through the years, constant training, retraining, sensitivity training, break their values. Right, no right, no wrong. You've got to have all religions represented, so, you know, tolerant of everything, and because that's the New World Order. Disorder, excuse me. Professor Benjamin Bloom is probably the most important behavioral psychologist ever to live. I mean, maybe not quite as much as Pavlov and Skinner, but he really implemented the system in education in the United States. And he was author of The Taxonomy of Educational Objectives. And I know that doesn't mean much to some. It means a lot to teachers. They know. All teachers have to go through that. Bloom's taxonomy. And just to give you an idea of how blatant they are, Benjamin Bloom said the purpose of education, and I often say this to parents, really, listen to this. You think the purpose of education is reading, writing, and arithmetic? The purpose of education is to change the thoughts, actions, and feelings of students. And then he goes on and he says, he defines good teaching, and this is even worse from the parental standpoint, as challenging the students' fixed beliefs. And then, in some of his works that I have, that are in my book, a lot of this stuff is in
When he says challenge, does he mean challenge or does he mean change? Change their fixed?
Yeah, through challenging. It's through challenging. You go up against them. And you change them. And you asked a good question, because then he goes on in one part of the taxonomy that is in my book. He says that he can take a student from here to there, from a belief in God or his country or whatever, to being an atheist and not believing in his country in 1 hour.
Did he do that?
Oh, yeah, he does it. And I've seen it with students. I've seen it with young people. And they don't even know, and teachers don't even know. That's why if you talk to teachers about it often, they'll really have an awfully hard time dealing with it. And if you go up to a superintendent, an educational administrative superintendent or whatever, and you ask him or her, have you ever been through sensitivity training? They'll usually crack up because they went through it. They're the worst, those programs. I've been through them. I mean, how can anything be worse than some of the ones that the regular classroom has? But they're the worst.
What do they teach them?
To bring about change. They put them through role-playing, psychodrama, all these psychological techniques where they play the part of starving children and the other one plays the part of a very wealthy industrialist child. And, you know, they bring about the attitude and value change through the emotions. You know how young people are. You know, they're naturally very altruistic. And they want to help, and they don't like to see poverty around the world. And so what they'll do is, just like I think I mentioned to you earlier, or I don't know whether I did, going into the teacher, putting in the new social studies program in our community and walking through, taking the little tots through town and identifying big, rich people's houses and small, poor people's houses. That's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. Getting them young and making them feel sorry for the people who live in the trailer across from the captain's house, because they only eat hot dogs, not steak. And then they'll do the same thing with Ethiopia or wherever, some third world country, showing them the children dying, and then they'll show pictures of our affluence. And what do you eat for breakfast? Oh, you have eggs and bacon and cereal and orange juice and grapefruit and everything, yum, yum, yum. Do you really think it's fair?
Many people write us about their experience with Extendivite. Allow me to read you some from Amazon.com. This product is superb. I have been taking it for about a year now, and I can feel my cardiovascular system run like a Swiss watch. I definitely recommend this product for anyone that has high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and heart palpitations, A+. It's potent, but it works. I have been waking up for the past 3 years with numb hands. And a week into using Extendivite, my numb hand seemed to have cleared up. My circulation was off, and now it's back on track. So I'm happy. I feel so energized, and I have my husband on it now. My mother-in-law has cholesterol problems, so I bought her a bottle as well. Thank you so much. Love the product. Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. Call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite. You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.